in Oregon. You know, your two senators are not yet supporters of the Smarter Sentencing Act in the Senate, so you can write to them at our website and ask them to co-sponsor that bill. Some of your members of Congress in the House of Representatives have not yet co-sponsored the Safe Justice Act, so you can also write to them at our website at our Get Involved page and ask them to co-sponsor that legislation.
And that's a good place to close. Well, again, this is Political Perspectives. I'm Doug McVeigh. We've been speaking with Molly Gill, Government Affairs Counsel for the organization Families Against Mandatory Minimums, or FAM. Molly, thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is KBOO. The time is just about 10 o'clock, 10:15 Flashpoints will be with us, and then the bike show at 11. But for now, we're going to go directly to Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO.
Cascadia. Today is September 2nd, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. Coming up today, we're going to talk foreign policy with Robert Naiman of Just Foreign Policy. The mainstream media has been overflowing with news of Obama getting his Iran deal. Maybe he's distracted by that, and indeed he should be. But his Alaska adventures are indeed astonishing in their sheer arrogance and hypocrisy. We'll also be speaking, of course, with Steve Horn from Desmog Blog, the intrepid and unstoppable in research for Desmog Blog, which clears, of course, is managing somehow to clear PR pollution. He had said today that Obama's a trip to the Arctic and Alaska is a pretending to be a deep green ecologist. Meanwhile, his policies across the board, in every case, free trade agreements, the whole works, belie the fact that President Obama really, when it comes to the environment, has very little to say and much to make amends for. But first, we're going to speak with Robert Naiman because this is an extraordinary event. President did, in fact, manage to round up 34. People who are willing to actually make the effort to understand what goes on in the world beyond their small constituency. Good morning, Robert. Thank you very much for joining us again. This is really extraordinary, isn't it? The Senate votes that he managed to round up, and the final one was just right at the absolute 11th hour. So this is going to be hard to hold together here at this end, but in Iran, how is this received at this point?
Well, so first of all, it's not actually the 11th hour. Any voting is expected to take place in mid-September. So we have at least a week. And I think this is key for people in Oregon to know, because one of your senators is supporting the deal, but your other, that's Merkley, yay Merkley, but Ron Wyden is listed as leaning no. So I hope that, and this is great news, that we reach 34, But I hope that no one in Oregon will let up any pressure on Wyden. On the contrary, I hope people will redouble pressure on Wyden, because there's a question here, not just, okay, now we know the deal is going to go through, but there's still a question of what kind of people do we want leading our country? What kind of people do we want leading the Democratic Party? This isn't the last time in human history that the U.S. is likely to face a choice between war and diplomacy. Chuck Schumer, one of two Senate Democrats against the deal, he voted for the Iraq War. So these people hang around and get to weigh in again. And so, you know, what kind of senators does Oregon want to have? Do you want to have Ron Wyden as your senator if he opposes the deal? Or conversely, do you want, you know, to pressure Ron Wyden to do the right thing, so you have two Oregon Democratic senators supporting the deal? And the practical consequence of that going forward immediately is that if 41 Democratic senators stand up now we have 34. If 41 Democratic senators stand up and say, yes, we support the deal, then the Senate Republicans can't even pass their resolution of disapproval, and it never will get to President Obama's desk for him to veto it in the first place. And that would be a very decisive message to the world from the United States, that we think we really learned something important from the Iraq fiasco, and we're doing something differently now. And it'll be a message from the United States to itself. Maybe we won't have to go through rituals like this so much in the future, because the people won't take so seriously the warmongering faction. But they say, okay, well, yeah, there are those people, but when push came to shove, the American people and their representatives went the other way. So maybe we don't have to give these warmongering voices so much attention anymore.
That would be devoutly to be hoped for, indeed. And in just briefly before we have to let you go, in Iran, much the same pattern prevails. There are right-wing, very religious fundamentalists, the mullahs, that are likely to oppose anything that the U.S. does. And with little understanding of cultural biases and the basis of all of this. In Iran, have you heard, how has this news been received?
Well, look, the death faction exists in Iran, but it has lost, at least for now, just like it's lost in the United States, at least for now. The elected government in Iran is strongly in support of the deal. The supreme leader, who's the ultimate authority, has you know, endorsed everything that has happened up to this point and has kept the right wing in check. So there's no reason, and you know, the reaction to the deal being announced is positive. You have to remember that for most people in the world, the relationship between the President of the United States and the U.S. Congress is an internal U.S. matter. The deal was, you know, for as far as the rest of the world is concerned, the deal's already done. They already signed the deal. The President of the United States already signed the deal. So it's over. So it was already over before today. This is, so the 34 thing, this is like a U.S. thing. It's not like an international thing.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for that. I just want to say, too, just foreign policy. I mean, I don't want to be too blatant about this. I just want to commend listeners' attention to this website. It has been incredibly persistent in encouraging people to understand what's going on, to sign the petition, to get this done. So we think that you know, this is all a matter of what happens in the Senate, and there's a great deal that happens when people read things like Just Foreign Policy. and are given avenues to take action to understand what's going on. So I think that just foreign policy did play a role in accomplishing this, and that's not to be overlooked. And thank you so much for that, Robert. We really appreciate you coming on the show again. Welcome back. Our next guest, of course, is Steve Horn, and we welcome Steve back as well. He research fellow at DeSmogblog, and weighing in on Obama's adventures in Alaska, adventures basically in hypocrisy, arrogance, and utter and complete failure to understand that climate and environment are one and the same thing, and that we should be talking about environment collapse, not just climate collapse. Good morning, Steve. Thank you for being with us again today. We really appreciate it.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, so there he is, man, sounding off, and the idea being, and now, of course, he's getting a little worried about other nations cashing in on the Arctic riches. All of this is very worrisome. Do you see the people really taking this trip to Alaska seriously? I mean, I don't see how any person who still has a pulse can understand this is anything but grandstanding and PR.
I think that it's being taken a lot less seriously than he had hoped. I think that the media narrative is, again, not what him and his administration and the White House had hoped. So there's a lot of headlines right now that are talking about this, you know, the contradiction, the fact that he, of course, approved of Arctic drilling and is giving Shell a permit to drill in the Arctic at the same time that he's going to the Arctic to talk about climate change. And, you know, Shell only has the opportunity to even drill in the Arctic because of the impacts of climate change and the melting Arctic. So I think that, but there's been a lot of headlines saying that, so this isn't anything new. And I think that what's more interesting to me is still some of the language that's being used to talk about Obama and trying to make moral pleas with Obama for him to, you know, start caring about his quote-unquote climate legacy, or the headlines calling him a hypocrite. You know, of course he's sort of a hypocrite, but I mean that's obvious. But I think that a little less obvious, you know, to look a little bit deeper, is what got this moving, and I think that's even more important. So that's something I wrote about months ago. The National Petroleum Council, which is a permanent advisory committee to the Department of Energy, to the Secretary of Energy, and ultimately to the White House. They're the ones who, which is a consortium of CEOs of oil and gas companies and other elites in D.C. that are connected to the oil and gas industry. They're the ones who published a report in March recommending Arctic drilling. That report was ordered way back in October 2013. So we're talking about a process that's been moving for a long time. Ultimately, Obama is more of a manager of these advisory committees and that sort of thing. So he's someone who has been doing things that are friendly to the oil and gas industry his entire time in the White House. So I think this is not exactly surprising. I think that I think that it's important not to get too caught up in sort of this great man theory of history, or this sort of great leader theory of history, and look at more of the structures and institutions that made this possible than seeing Obama more as a manager of that structure.
Well, yeah, we see it as further encroachment of the progressive corporatization of government, and that corporate, as you said, the National Petroleum Conference, they really are calling the shots. Obama doesn't know very much, in fact, about any of this, and his so-called advisors obviously are asleep at the wheel, or possibly part of the conference themselves.
This is something that's been in place, it's not something new. It's been locked in there since 1946. That's when the National Petroleum Council was created, and it's, of course, the Department of Energy has been around for just about as long. So this is something that was born after World War II, hasn't subsided since. And I think that, I think American citizens should probably, and I think environmentalists who care about climate change, should pay more attention to these institutions and what they're doing rather than focus on trying to convince Obama about his quote-unquote climate legacy. You know, I think that ultimately that's just a narrative that plays into what he's doing right now. He's there to, you know, to do a PR trip for his quote-unquote climate legacy. So no matter, you know, if you're playing into that game, it's a game that he'll win. So, and obviously the headlines, going back to what we started, the headlines haven't been exactly what he wanted, but still now, if you look at the backlash, there's actually been a lot of headlines now. Today you see in the Washington Post, they ran a headline saying, no, and I'm reading it right now, no, Obama isn't the climate hypocrite. What the White House has been doing is feeding friendly reporters storylines that can respond to the negative headlines. So, of course, if you get into this game, then it's probably a game that the White House is ultimately going to win for PR because they're the ones who are connected to the elite media.
Sure, they're a bigger target, too. That we've got about a minute left, if that. But I just want to ask you in closing, Obama makes it is a huge target. People can call up the White House and leave messages and so forth and try to make a statement that way. It's a little more difficult to reach National Petroleum Council members and tell them what you think. So what would you suggest? I mean, we follow this, especially people read your pieces that come out to Smog Blog and many, many other places, and stay out in front of it as much as possible. But what do you do when faced with this amorphous and extremely powerful entity that has been
That's a fair question. I think that ultimately the National Petroleum Council isn't exactly amorphous. They meet at least annually, I think actually twice a year, in Washington, D.C., so it's not like their meetings are meetings are public. They have to publicize what the meetings are, so it's not like it's a place that activists couldn't be at to try to, say, have their voices heard outside of the meeting or get into the meeting and raise their voices. So I think it's a target to start thinking about more. And, of course, President Obama is someone you don't think about as someone that's a present target.